Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. A very sincere thank you to Matt Swain for taking over the hosting duties yesterday for me. I appreciate it. I needed a day off. I got a day off and I am rip-roaring, ready to go for Friday. And just in time for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, one of the best hours we do every month. Weird Questions means, well, basically any kind of offbeat, unusual question that maybe we, you know, it just does, it's off the beaten path. I guess you probably know what the word weird is. I don't know why I'm describing that, but we're not calling the questioner weird, just the question. Like sometimes people have very odd questions, things we maybe haven't heard before, and we collect those up. Mostly Jimmy collects them up, and then we share them here on this show. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of a whole bunch of things, including The Drama of Salvation, which we've given out a few times recently, Jimmy, even when you weren't here.
Oh, okay.
People want to know, how am I saved?
That's an important question to ask, and not a weird one at all.
No, that's not a weird one. Actually, yeah, that falls in. But if you have questions about other dimensions, other planets, possible strange occurrences like ghosts or giant monsters that live in the deep, and how would a Catholic respond to them? All those are appropriate for weird questions.
Swim away.
Swim away from the monster?
Yeah, that lives in the deep. Oh. Swim away from it.
All right. What about those kind that can only detect motion? And just, I guess.
You mean a motion detector?
That's not the monsters. Isn't that like one of the things from Jurassic Park? But I
so,
think that, go
so,
ahead. Yeah.
So
I should have known you would know.
Michael Crichton got this wrong in the first Jurassic Park movie. Yep. Michael Crichton is the author of the original Jurassic Park book that was the basis of the movie. And he got it wrong that Tyrannosaurus can't see things that don't move. And so in the first Jurassic Park movie, there's a scene where a Tyrannosaurus is on a rampage and it like eats this one guy, but then it looks at some people and they don't move and it just moves on.
Right.
And then it was pointed out by actual paleontologists that no, Tyrannosaurus did not have motion-based vision. They could see perfectly well.
Oh.
And so in at least the novel for Jurassic Park 2, Michael Crichton retconned that.
Oh.
Retcon is a term from the comic book industry. It means retroactive continuity.
Yeah.
You apply an explanation to something retroactively that maybe you got wrong the first time.
Right.
And so in the novel, apparently, for Jurassic Park 2, they raised the question of why would this Tyrannosaur have not eaten the people who remained motionless? And, well, okay, maybe it had just eaten somebody else so it wasn't hungry.
That's not the best retcon I've ever heard.
No.
It's pretty mediocre.
But it kind of works.
It is good to know in case I run into a Tyrannosaur.
That, yeah. Don't count on being still.
Right. Probably can't count on much if you're in the crosshairs. I was going to give out the number, but I'm not going to give out the number because I'm going to read some questions to you first. As I said, Jimmy Akin, our guest. It is Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy Akin also does a podcast called Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, in which you tackle similar weird questions, but in much more greater detail.
Yeah, broad topics.
Yeah, topics. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like ghosts or Bigfoots.
Yeah, the one that just went up today is the mystery of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Oh, yeah. So that's interesting. So that's not exactly the same as – well,
no,
you wouldn't normally put that in with like Bigfoot,
no,
for example.
The way the show is explained is it's a podcast that examines mysteries both natural and supernatural.
Yeah.
So the natural ones include historical mysteries like Watergate or the Dead Sea Scrolls or Jack the Ripper or whatever you might have, in addition to the supernatural ones like ghosts and demons and things like that.
What is the plural of Bigfoot, by the way? Is it big feet or Bigfootses?
I don't know that dictionaries have taken on that subject, and so I think both are acceptable. I think also Bigfoot can also be a collective noun like sheep.
Oh, yeah. Look at all those Bigfoot.
Bigfoot. Yeah, that would work. Uh-huh. Most people, I think, use Bigfoots, however. I think that's the standard usage.
Oh, there's one Bigfoot. Wait, no, there's two Bigfoots.
Yeah.
Yeah, I gotcha. Can I give you a question, a weird question?
Yeah,
sure. Can we start off?
Mm-hmm.
Dennis asks, was Moses circumcised? If he was, why was his heritage a surprise to him?
Well, presumably Moses was circumcised, not just because he was Jewish, but because Egyptians also practiced circumcision.
Oh.
And so there, if he was unaware of his heritage, you know, the fact he was circumcised would not have told him that he was one of the Hebrew babies or had been one of the Hebrew babies, because Egyptians were also circumcised. However, I don't know that his heritage came as any kind of surprise to him. If you read early on in the book of Exodus, where Moses' early life is being described, he was adopted, of course, by Pharaoh's daughter, and then he was wet nursed by his own mother for a period presumably of like 2-3 years, you know, which was typical for how long they breastfed children back then. And so during it's quite likely that he would have been aware of his heritage, either because he would have heard the story even from his own family members about how he came to be adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, or simply because there was no secret of it in the royal court, that everybody knew that Pharaoh's daughter had not been pregnant. So this baby shows up. It was one of the Hebrew babies that had been ordered to be put to death, but she had mercy on him. That's an exceptional thing. And so that would have even if his adopted mother had not told him about it, other people in the court would have been aware of it, and likely would have been the scuttlebutt among the servants. He might have been taunted, you know, when other boys in the court heard about this, and it's like, oh, you're not one of us, you're a Hebrew. And then when he's an adult, one of the first things that he does that we're told about is he intervenes in a fight between an Egyptian and a Hebrew, and he ends up killing the Egyptian and hides his body in the sand. And that displays seems to display a consciousness of that the Hebrew he was defending was one of his own kinsmen, and that he could get in trouble for having killed the Egyptian, which he presumably would not have if he was being raised as if he were a normal Egyptian prince. He might not have gotten in trouble in that kind of situation. It's like, hey, there was a fight. I intervened. I ended up accidentally killing the guy. What we do see later on is that after Moses has gone to the land of Midian and acquired his wife Zipporah there, they have a son, Gershom, and he has not circumcised Gershom and gets in trouble for that with God, and Zipporah ends up circumcising Gershom and saving Moses' life. But that's not an indication that Moses wasn't circumcised. It's just an indication that he had failed in one of his covenant duties once he was out of the land of Egypt, away from where people were normally circumcised, away from his fellow Hebrews and so forth. So he was living in an uncircumcised land, and he followed that custom.
Oh, so it had the – yeah, I see. It has the implication of kind of assimilating a little bit there. All right. Well, Dennis, thank you very, very much for that question. Brian asks the following question. Scientists are suspending the life of separated animal brains.
Mm-hmm.
What is Catholic thought on this?
Well, in principle, the Catholic Church wouldn't have a problem with it, not in terms of Catholic moral theology. So what they're doing here is they're saying, okay, let's say we have a lab animal and we want to take the brain out of the lab animal for research purposes, and we want to keep the brain alive. Maybe, for example, so that we can learn more about how brains work and then later bring those techniques back to serve humanity, so that we can do better brain surgery once we understand how the brain works or things like that. And so there can be legitimate research purposes for having a disembodied animal brain that you're keeping alive. And animals don't have rights, so it's not like you're violating the animal's rights by doing this. You can do, in principle, other similar tests on animals. Because they're not human beings, that's why we do animal testing in the first place. As long as it's in service of a legitimate research goal, such as helping humans and so forth in the long run, it's in principle legitimate to say, okay, what can we do here? How can we keep this brain functioning? What other things can we learn about it? We do have an obligation, because not because of animal rights, but because of our nature as humans. We have an obligation to be compassionate and not to do things to animals that cause them suffering unnecessarily. So there needs to be a legitimate purpose. You shouldn't like take an animal and remove its brain and then keep its brain alive just for the fun of it. Because right. The animal's not going to presumably have as good a time without its body as it would with its body. So unless there's some legitimate goal that counterbalances what you're doing to the animal, then you want to treat the animal humanely and without causing it unnecessary distress or discomfort or anything like that. But if there is a legitimate goal, then you could do that.
Say you go super advanced society and you could take out a person's brain, it wouldn't be right to...
You're changing the question now.
Yeah, but I just want to be clear on this, because this really bothers me. It wouldn't be right to like kidnap a passing person from a spaceship and take their brain out and run your city using their brain like a supercomputer.
Well, not a human's brain, but maybe a Vulcan brain, Mr. Spock's brain.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. As a matter of fact, that's the name of that episode, isn't
Spock's
it?
Spock's brain, yeah.
All right. We've got to take a break.
By the way, hypothetically, since we're doing the fringe weird stuff today, so could there be a legitimate reason for keeping a human brain alive outside of its body?
I imagine there could be, but I
would imagine there could be too if the rest of their body is died, but if we had a way to keep a human brain alive and like give it a new body, let's say, maybe a mechanical one, that's a trope of science fiction. You have heroes like Robot Man.
Yeah, right.
In DC Comics, he was a race car driver. His body was wrecked. He would have completely died in a car crash, except they were able to save his brain and give him a robot body, and he was able to continue living. That's not in principle different than replacing other parts of the body with prostheses. Yeah. Like if someone loses a leg, you give him a prosthetic leg. If someone loses a hand, you give him a prosthetic hand. Someone loses an eye, you could hypothetically one day give him an eye. In fact, if you gave someone a mechanical eye and a mechanical arm and a couple of mechanical legs, it might even, it could be expensive. It might total like, say,
it's about $6 million.
$6 million, you could do that.
You could rebuild them.
We have the technology.
You can make them better than he was. Bulk up for the fall this weekend with free shipping. We are offering free shipping within the continental United States on all cases ordered of our bulk book special. These include the bestsellers Why We're Catholic, Made This Way, Persuasive Pro-Life, and all of our 20 Answers titles, with the price of $1 to $5 per copy on the books themselves when you go to the bulk book specials category at shop.catholic.com. For the next few days, you'll also get the shipping free. Limit 3 cases per title. Go to shop.catholic.com and get your books in bulk this weekend.
Got questions? Visit us today at catholic.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Don't you feel sometimes like there's so many people in the world, how does he hear your prayer? Never think of that, huh? Everybody thinks that. I'm only a little grain of sand on the seashore. Oh, but that's not true. See, God is God. And you and I have to let God be God. I don't know how he does it. He's God.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Second hour, Carlo Broussard will be here. We're going to talk about answering the Protestant challenge. This hour, weird questions with Jimmy Akin. And it's working out great because Jimmy Akin is our guest. And these questions have been submitted via the various ways you can submit questions here. And Jimmy kind of collects them up for us. And the next one is from Anne. Jimmy, I want to know if there will come a time when God stops creating souls.
Okay, I'm going to answer this in terms of human souls.
Okay.
First, in terms of human souls, yes, as far as we know.
Okay.
Because at one point, human history will end. The dead will be raised. We're told that in the resurrection, we're going to be like the angels, neither marrying nor giving in marriage. And so that would indicate that the human population at that point is immortal and stable. And thus there would be no new human souls being created, at least in our world as far as we know. Now, if there are parallel worlds where God also has humans, they might not hit that final state at the same time as us. So he might be creating human souls elsewhere. But for us in our world, as far as we know, there will come a time where there will be no more souls being created. At least as far as humans go. Now, when it comes to souls of other living creatures, we do have indications, at least in the imagery that's used in the Book of Revelation, that there will be life on the new heavens and earth. And since every living creature is understood to have a soul of some kind, even if it's not necessarily one that survives death, but at least it has a life principle that keeps its body alive, we do have an indication of life existing in the next world. In fact, the tree of life is said to exist or is depicted in Revelation as existing in the heavenly city, New Jerusalem. Now, it's hard to know exactly how to interpret that symbolism beyond it means we're going to have access to immortality again. Whether there will be a literal tree like that is another question that is harder to discern the answer to. However, we are innately biological creatures that are part of the material world. Scripture depicts us as having a, physical, material, continued existence after the resurrection. And even though we say maybe won't need food or things like that, I would expect that God would adorn the future state of the earth with other living things the way that he adorned this one with other living things, and those other living things would have souls. And if they're not given a special gift of immortality, like we will be, then their bodies will break down over time, and they will thus need to reproduce themselves to keep their populations going. And that would mean the creation of new souls of an animal or vegetative nature for them.
And so that, to me, that leaves the question of angels. Has God already made all the angels that will be made, or do we not know that either?
Well, we don't know that for sure. We're not given any evidence of ongoing creation of angels.
Yeah.
However, we know that they don't reproduce, so it would have to be new creations by God. If they do, but we're not told of any new creations of angels by God. In fact, there's been a speculation theologically, and this is nothing more than a speculation. This is not church teaching, but there has been a speculation that that humans are being used to replace in the heavenly hierarchy the angels that fell. So a certain number of angels fell, and the idea is that God is going to make up that number of missing heavenly courtiers with saved humans. And so that's an interesting idea, but it's not something that is actually taught by the church or in Scripture.
All right, Anne, thank you very much for that question. Next comes from Ryan. I am not sure I believe Ryan's question. He says, my five-year-old—
Wait.
What?
Believing a question? A question is just a question. It doesn't have a truth value.
Yeah, but here, listen to the question and I'll tell you why I don't believe it. My five-year-old, Patrick, wants to know why Jesus made dinosaurs. I suspect it's Ryan that wants to know this, and he's just— he's covering it.
No, his claim is that his son wants to know this, but the question itself doesn't have a truth value.
Okay, fair enough.
If I say, what time is it? It's like you can't say, false!
I could, but it would be nonsensical.
Right.
But I'm not above nonsense.
Well,
I
won't comment on that.
Allegedly, it's Patrick that has this question, and Patrick is 5 years old. So why?
I don't find that hard to believe. I wondered about things like that as a kid, too.
Why did Jesus make dinosaurs?
Because they're cool.
That's what I think,
I mean,
too.
That's the basic answer, especially, you know, for someone who's very young.
Yeah.
I can give a more detailed answer for people who are a little older. The more detailed answer is that every creature that God makes reflects some of the ways that God himself is great. Mm-hmm. And so God chose to display his glory by making creatures that reflect his glory. And so he made dinosaurs to reflect his glory, which is another way of saying, 'cause they're cool.
Yeah.
Also, one might propose an additional reason, which is that from what we can tell based on modern scientific findings, it looks like evolution is true, and therefore, even though we're not directly descended from dinosaurs, the dinosaurs, because of how prominent they were in Earth's history, would have had a role in shaping the evolution of our ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're mammals, so we're descended from creatures that were alive at the same time as the dinosaurs, but they were kind of kept in check mm-hmm. by the big dinosaurs, you know, who were the right. dominant things on Earth at the time. And our ancestors really couldn't make progress in terms of growing and filling different niches in the environment until the dinosaurs passed away. And so you can look at the presence of the dinosaurs as something that played a role in God's plan in terms of how our ancestors developed. And so in addition to creating dinosaurs just because they're cool and reflect God's glory, you can also propose that God also used the existence of the dinosaurs as a way of helping prepare our ancestors and other life forms for the arrival of man on Earth.
I hope that answer is satisfying, Ryan. I mean, Patrick.
False.
Dinosaurs are cool, though.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. I think we have
even
time.
The hot-blooded ones.
There were hot-blooded dinosaurs? Come
yeah.
on, really?
Oh, yeah.
Is any of that I know of?
Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Was hot-blooded?
Yeah.
Huh.
There were, I mean, you don't think that it, you don't think you got a multi-ton meat eater with no fast metabolism to allow it to hunt, do you?
Well, you say it like I'm dumb, but I never thought of that.
I mean, you know, you've seen like lizards that are cold-blooded that are, you know.
All over my yard. I got lizards everywhere this year.
Yeah,
I don't know why.
Well, if you see like big ones like Komodo dragons and stuff,
I don't have any
they kind of
those.
Are slow.
Oh, yeah.
And if at least plant-eating ones are slow. If you plant-eating lizards and turtles and things like that are slow. If you want to hunt, though, you need a fast metabolism.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Let's try Richard. Richard asks, this is a kind of a little bit of a novel. Mm-hmm. You live in the universe of The Walking Dead, in which it is a biological certainty that a human being who dies will remain as a flesh-eating zombie unless the brain is destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
If you are bitten, you will contract a terrible fever that will certainly kill you. Does the principle of double effect make it permissible for you to take steps that after you're bitten would destroy your brain in order to avoid becoming a death trap for others?
The way the question is phrased, the answer is yes, but you have to do it carefully. You can't kill an innocent person.
Okay.
And therefore, you have to wait until the person is either dead, assuming you actually temporarily die before you come back as a zombie.
Yeah.
And then as soon as you're dead, well, then, you know, the cinder block falls on your head or whatever and crushes your brain, and that's fine, and because you were dead at the time.
I gotcha.
Or if you don't really die, but you just kind of go into a coma and then emerge as a aggressive zombie. You need to arrange so that your brain is destroyed after you've become an aggressor.
I see. Yeah, because then you wouldn't be an innocent party.
Correct.
Anymore.
You'd be a threat to other life, and thus would be able to. Now, you might be subjectively innocent, but that's not what we're talking about. You don't you can kill an aggressor even though they're crazy and out of their head and are subjectively innocent. If they're attacking you, you can defend yourself or defend others. And that's what this would amount to, is proxy self-defense. You're defending others by arranging for your own death after you've become an aggressor and are no longer in control of yourself.
Mm-hmm. It would be pretty impressive engineering, though, to do that second one. Like, I can't think of
depends.
A word.
Oh, well, okay. So, you know, it's going to, you could, let's say, chain yourself up and have a bomb set to go off after you, a time that you know you will have become an aggressor by. So you can't get away from the bomb because of the chain. And, you know, you will be an aggressor because you've set the timer late enough that the virus will have done its work.
That's a very good little way to conclude the first half of Weird Questions
with
Jimmy Aiken.
Wouldn't that be good to have in a zombie apocalypse?
It would be great to have around. You got to work on your cardio, though, in a zombie universe. We'll be right back with more Weird Questions with Jimmy Aiken on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Dr. Scott Hahn, and stay tuned for more Catholic Answers Live.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old children or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture decays, we have to know how to talk to our children about these issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging onto the shop at Catholic.com.
With the recent commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the release of Humanae Vitae, there have been fresh attacks on Catholic teaching from outside and, unfortunately, inside the Church. That's why Catholic Answers thought it critical to provide a vigorous affirmation of Pope Paul VI's prophetic wisdom with our newest book, Inseparable, 5 Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humanae Vitae. We asked 5 distinguished contributors to reflect on and defend Humanae Vitae from 5 perspectives, each of them compelling, together forming a mosaic of truth. Don't be caught uninformed when the topic comes up among friends, family, and coworkers. Order your copy of Inseparable today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or by visiting the shop at Catholic.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Friday, and this Friday is Weird Question Day. Weird Questions with Jimmy Aiken. Jimmy Aiken, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. That you could order that right now at shop.catholic.com. That's how easy it is to get that book. And it's worth it, too. 365 questions and answers in how would we say it? Easy-to-use format.
Easy to read.
Yep.
Very short.
Right. All on a single page.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's weird questions. So people have submitted these questions to us, mostly from Facebook, I think. And Richard is up next. No, we just did Richard, The Walking Dead. Okay. So John. Weird question. Well, this seems a good question. I like it. I'm not sure it's completely weird. Is beauty objective? Recently, I heard a theology professor on Catholic Answers say that beauty was subjective, and I was very troubled after hearing that because I always heard the contrary.
Hmm. So I don't know who this may have been, and I didn't hear the broadcast, so I can't really comment on that. But I can comment on the question, and you're right. This isn't the weirdest one in the batch.
Yeah.
But I would say that the answer is a mix, that there is a degree to which beauty is objective and there's a degree to which beauty is subjective. One of the things that we found by studying things people find beautiful is that they display certain qualities, like symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at a beautiful person's body, they are going to display certain kinds of symmetry. You know, like their eyes are going to be on the same level. They're going to have their ears are going to be on the same level. But then, if you imagine someone who has like one eye half an inch lower than the other eye, that person's, which would be asymmetrical, that person's not going to appear as beautiful.
Okay.
So there is an objective quality to beauty, including physical beauty. There are also things like in mathematics where certain – and in physics where certain equations are beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And scientists will regularly talk about how the beauty of these equations is something that compels them to go forward with their studies and so forth. So I think that there is an objective quality aspect to beauty, but there's also a subjective aspect. Not every person has the same tastes in beauty. Mm. Not every species has the same tastes in beauty. I was watching a documentary once about lions. And one of the things that they had found by studying lions was that female lions found male lion images of male lions more attractive if the whisker patterns that they have on their muzzle displayed symmetry.
Oh,
just
some.
Just like so, there's an objective thing that the female lions were cueing in on, but human women typically do not find male lions attractive. I mean, they might, you know, not in the way female lions do. Let's put it that way.
That is a fascinating point, Jimmy.
So, and vice versa. So we see that there's a subjective aspect here. Humans find humans attractive in a way lions don't. Lions find lions attractive in a way humans don't.
Mm-hmm.
Even within our own species, though, there are different standards of aesthetics. There's a learned component to them. One of the things that I remember also in college, I believe, I was taking a course on anthropology or maybe it was film studies, but it was one of the two. And they were talking about how when films were being shown to like a tribe somewhere in the developing world that had not seen films before, they were watching the film and they appreciated the long shots that they would have where you get to see
more.
But then when a close-up would happen on like a person's face,
yeah,
they would object and say, no, we want to see a whole person. And so they hadn't learned that because motion pictures were new to them, they hadn't learned
mm-hmm.
the language of modern motion pictures whereby using a close-up, you're focusing attention on a person's face so you can see the emotional impact
right.
of what's happening more on that person. So there's a kind of visual language that filmmakers developed over the years. But if you're coming to it new, then if it's not part of your experience, then you may read it differently.
Right.
I know in my own background, at one point I was listening, because I wasn't raised Catholic, I wasn't raised with organ music in church. To me, organ music was largely, you know, what mad scientists played.
Yeah, or a Bela Lugosi movie or something.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember once listening to an album of Bach organ music, and I suddenly realized, oh, this is not meant to be mad scientist music. This is meant to be like church music.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was a moment in my own aesthetic education. And I've noticed also that like if I listen to an album, and I'm dating myself by using the word album, but if I listen to
– for the youngsters, those were collections of songs on vinyl.
Yeah. What later became CDs and now I don't know what they call them.
Downloads.
We don't use CD. Yeah, but it's a collection of
yeah,
say,
right.
songs. And I often found the first time I listened to an album, I wasn't that wild about it. But then,
mm-hmm.
as I listened to it again and again, I would start to appreciate what the musicians were doing because now I was understanding what they were trying to do. And I found the same thing would happen with novels and things like that. Oftentimes my first pass through something is not my favorite pass. That as I learn a work of art, as I learn more about a work of art, I appreciate it more. And that reflects the more subjective aspect of beauty. As I learn more about it, I can as a subject,
yes,
I can appreciate it more.
Right, right. Yeah. Who was that? That was John. John, thank you very much for that question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. And we go now to Rick, who says, my six-year-old wants to know.
Oh, are you going to doubt this one too? Skeptical sigh.
I just think the dads, we have a tendency, like, if we want to go see a really good Disney movie, we go, our kid wants to see it. That's why. But we really want to see it. If we want to ask a question about dinosaurs, we say the kid wants to know.
Well, but it may be true that the kid wants to know. The dad may also want to know.
Exactly. All right. Fair enough. Rick claims his six-year-old wants to know, if a baby dies, will it be a baby in heaven? And will it age in heaven?
Fascinating question. The answer is that the way Catholic I'm going to say it using words that a six-year-old might not know, but the way Catholic theologians, that means for a six-year-old, people who study God, the way Catholic theologians have understood the answer to this question is that when we're in heaven, we're going to be physically perfect. So we won't have either the problems we have when we're young or the problems physical problems that we have when we're young or the physical problems we have when we're old. And so it will at least be because we won't have physical problems.
Yeah.
And so that would mean that even though you might not be able to assign a physical age to a person easily, presumably they wouldn't be stuck as a baby for all eternity.
Right.
On the other hand, they wouldn't be aging either. It's like in this life, you start aging and there's no way to stop it. There's no way to reverse it. You know, we can do little things we can do little things to you know, help us age in a healthy way.
Yeah.
But our bodies are constantly experiencing the aging process. But they won't be aging either in the next world in heaven. So, in the resurrection, I would say someone who died as a baby will have a perfect human form that will not be either subject to the limitations of youth or the limitations of old age. Now, you'll notice I said that in a kind of careful way because we do see evidence in the case of Jesus of him being able, when he wants, to appear with defects like the wounds from the cross, from the crucifixion.
I see. Yeah, right.
And so we also see evidence that he could potentially change his appearance.
Yeah.
In his resurrected form. And so I would think, and since we're told we're going to be like Jesus in terms of what it's going to be like for us in the resurrection, I would say that even though we're not going to be limited by youth or old age or the problems we have in those phases of life, it may be possible for us at will to assume those appearances.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might be able to appear as a baby if you want in the resurrection, or to appear as an old man, or to appear in other ways. And so so that's – we can't be sure here, but that's the way the evidence seems to point. So I would say that a baby baby won't have a body at all until the resurrection if someone dies as a baby. So the question doesn't really arise until we get to the resurrection. My suspicion is that someone who died as a baby will be able to appear as any age they choose to
in
the resurrection.
I would imagine most people would choose 54 then. It's like the perfect age.
I'll take your word on that.
Yeah, people who
I'll
are
let 50. You know when I get there.
Oh, Jimmy Akin. Hey, we'd like you to join the Radio Club. We give away free stuff pretty much every week at Radio Club, something. At the very least, you get a letter and we tell you what's up and we ask you for your input. We have poll questions regularly in the Radio Club email. And as I said, we give away free stuff. Sometimes it's an MP3.
Have you mentioned we give away free stuff?
We do, in fact, give away free. I wonder if I had mentioned that. I don't know. At 54, yeah, I can't always remember what I just said. But the way you join Radio Club, and we really want you to join Radio Club, is you just text all one word, Radio Club, to 44222. Text Radio Club, one word, to 44222. If you don't do that texting thing, you can also join online by going to CatholicAnswersLive.com and find the Radio Club registration button. We'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin and Weird Questions after this.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
I feel that God has been really doing a work in me in the last 5-10 years. I'm a convert to Catholicism, and I started to just really feel a passion to know more about the Catholic faith, and I started listening to Catholic radio all day. I'm not doing great things, but I'm doing small things with great love.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. We got a whole bunch of weird questions. And Brandon, the video guy, pretended to be Lindsay from South Carolina to ask the following question. Why are you looking at me like that, Brandon? You didn't know I was going to out you like that? Sorry. But this is actually from Brandon behind the cameras there. Why do male seahorses give birth?
Male seahorses give birth because the basic answer is because their species evolved that way. So what happens in seahorse reproduction? Now, in the case of many animals that live underwater, neither species gives birth. Mm-hmm. So like typical way fish reproduce is the female will lay eggs on a rock, the male will fertilize those eggs, and then the parents leave and the eggs are left to hatch on their own. In some cases, a parent may hang around. So in like the case of some octopus species, the correct plural of which of octopus is octopodes.
What?
Yeah, because it's from the Greek word pos, meaning foot.
Yeah.
Eight foot, octopode. Oh.
Not octofeet.
No. In some species of octopus, the female will lay the eggs, the male will fertilize them, and then the female will watch them until they hatch and like protect them,
mm-hmm.
and then she'll die. And what
it's a cruel world.
Yeah, but what they found that's fascinating is the death is visually triggered. So she needs to see the babies hatching before her death reflex triggers. Uh-huh. And so they've had situations where they've experimentally blinded the female octopus so she can't see the babies hatch and she just keeps on living.
So if your eye causes you to die, you pluck it out?
Something like that, yeah.
Okay.
In any event, in the case of seahorses, the males have a pouch, like kind of like kangaroos do.
Yeah.
And the female lays the eggs into the male's pouch,
mm-hmm.
where they're fertilized. And then the male carries them for, you know, a few days or weeks, however long it is in a given species. And then he gives birth.
Okay.
So that's how he gets the eggs, is they're deposited in him by the female. But there's a fascinating consequence to this because he's the one that carries them. He has the bigger biological investment in the offspring. The same way in our species, humans, you were aware we're humans, right?
Vaguely.
Mostly.
Yeah,
okay.
Mostly humans?
Yeah. Okay. Most of us are. So in our species, females, women, have the bigger biological investment in the offspring because they've got to carry the offspring and it's like 9 months and they have to undergo all this inconvenience. They also have fewer chances to reproduce. Mm-hmm. You know, there's only a certain number of children a given woman could have in a year. But if a man were to have, let's say, a huge harem like Genghis Khan did, he could have loads of children in a given lifetime.
Right.
So that shows us there's a differential between the sexes in terms of which sex has more biological investment in the offspring because it's a greater cost to that sex. And it even in humans continues after birth because only women can nurse babies.
Yes.
And so before, you know, formula and domestication of farm animals, the only way you had to get milk to a child was by nursing. Women have a much greater time and energy and safety because there are health risks. You know, I mean, you could die in childbirth. Mm-hmm. So they have a much greater biological investment in our offspring. Well, in seahorses, it's the reverse. The male, because he's the one that carries the babies, has the bigger biological investment. And what they found is that in different species, whichever sex, if one has a greater biological investment, that's the sex that gets to choose who to mate with normally.
Right.
And that's why in humans, men court women.
Yes.
And the women, because they if they get pregnant by a man, they've got the bigger burden, especially if he takes off and doesn't help. And so that's why women in the human species are choosier about men than men sometimes are about women.
So I like the use of sometimes.
Yeah. And in seahorses, it's the reverse.
Ah.
The males are the ones who play hard to get, and the females are the ones who court the males and try to win the male's affection.
Why does that not surprise me that you had an encyclopedic answer to that question? this is a question I wanted to get to, so I'm skipping ahead a little bit here. Brian asks, during teleportation, where is the person? Theoretical, of course. Before, after, during, at 20%. I like that he did it at 20%. So you're teleporting something like the Star Trek.
Okay. So the answer is going to depend on the type of teleportation you're using.
Mm-hmm.
In some versions of teleportation, kind of the most basic version of teleportation, it simply travel extremely rapidly. And so like if I'm here in San Diego and a second later I appear in New York, but I've covered all the space like a super fast jet flight that only took 1 second, that would still seem like teleportation to us. So in some people's – like if you read Larry Niven's essay on teleportation, Larry Niven being a science fiction writer, he counts that just super fast – motion as teleportation.
Okay.
In that case, if I'm 20% of the way between San Diego and New York at the moment, well, then that's where I am. I'm 20% of the way between. I'm at whatever stage of the journey I'm at in the slice of time you specify. Then there are other kinds of teleportation. Another kind of non-destructive teleportation where it doesn't, like in Star Trek, take your body apart into component atoms.
Yeah.
Another kind is also explored by Larry Niven in his Known Space series, where he has these devices, they're either called transfer booths or stepping disks, and they apparently access dimensions that are normally hidden to us, but you're like briefly in the blink of an eye shunted from one place to another through these hidden dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not taken apart. You're just shunted through this other dimension. So in that case, where you are in the middle of a teleport is you're somewhere in one of these hidden dimensions. In the case of Star Trek teleporters, where you're disassembled and reassembled elsewhere, there are a couple of ways of looking at it. If you take what they say on Star Trek most of the time in just a straightforward way that you're being deconstructed and the energy from your body is being transmitted to a new location and put back together, then at a certain point early in the teleportation process, you die. And so you, because your body's been taken apart, it's not functioning anymore. You don't have a body. And so you've just been murdered by the teleport, by the transporter. Then the remnants of your body, which are kind of like cremains, only you, they're like atomains in this case because you've been atomized, are moved to a new location and put back together. And you – so in that middle phase where you're dead, you're not anywhere. Maybe your soul – not physically. Your soul may have gone off to heaven. Or if certain theories about the soul are correct that have been talked about in Jewish and Christian history, such that the soul hangs around for a few days after the body has died. And this is sometimes thought to play a role in why Jesus doesn't resurrect Lazarus until like the fourth day, because the soul was thought to hang around for 3 days. So by waiting till the fourth day, Jesus is truly reaching into the next world. But suppose your soul does hang around for 3 days around your body. Well, okay, your body's just been atomized by the transporter, but if your soul's still hanging around those atoms, then when it gets put back together, that might be you. Or it might be a clone of you that has a brand new soul.
What?
Because it needs a soul if it's going to be a living body. And if your soul went off to heaven irretrievably, then this is like basically your identical twin, and it has no more the same soul as you than if you had an identical twin from birth. Would that twin have the same soul as you? Two different bodies, two different souls. Then there's what you find in a few episodes of Star Trek. In particular, there is one where in Next Generation where Lieutenant Barclay begins to experience things in mid-transport.
Oh, yes.
And so his consciousness is there. He's even attacked by like what seems to be a creature in mid-transport and reacts to it in mid-transport. And if that's the case, then that would suggest that your consciousness actually continues with your body in the transport process. And so you aren't actually taken apart and atomized. You're just transitioned into some other state of matter that lets you be moved from one place to another. But your body is actually still in this transitioned way, still functioning and so forth. So you're actually still alive. And you might be, depending on how that process works, smeared out over a wide swath of space between the transporter that is controlling the process and the destination point where you're headed to. And you might be in all of those different locations at once. So depends on the type of teleportation you're using.
Wow, that's a lot to think about. That's very interesting. I don't like the clone one.
That's kind of the most disturbing.
Let's get to Taylor. I think we can get this in before we have to go. And next hour, Carla Broussard will be here. Jimmy Akin with us for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Taylor asks, please describe how it might be possible for heaven, purgatory, earth, and hell to be in four or fewer different universes that we live within a multiverse environment.
Okay, four or fewer. Well, the way that it would be that those four realms could be in fewer universes is if we – obviously, they're, because we're talking about four different realms, they could be in as many as four different universes. In fact, it could be even more than that because in Jewish and Christian literature, there are multiple heavens. And maybe each heaven is a different universe. St. Paul talks about third heaven and visiting third heaven in a vision. Also, another first century Christian document, the Ascension of Isaiah, talks about seven heavens. So it's possible that there could be multiple heavens in meaning even more universes or dimensions or whatever you want to say. On the other hand, you could say it's less than that. You could say that it's less than four. You could, if you – and a lot of people historically did this, would say, well, hell really is located down in the bowels of the earth somewhere, and heaven really is located up in the sky somewhere. That's not what current findings indicate, but it would be possible to collapse these other realms into fewer than one dimension and one universe. Also, if by universe you mean physical universe, you could say there's only one physical universe. Ours and these other realms don't count as universes because they're not physical.
Hey, thanks everybody for who brought us weird questions. If you got a weird question for Jimmy Akin, you can email it to radio@catholic.com or submit it to Jimmy Akin's Facebook page or just get it to us anyway. We'll take it. As I said, next hour, Carlo Broussard will be here answering the Protestant challenge. Jimmy Akin, thank you for another fine hour.
Thank you, Si.
And have a great weekend.
You too.
Coming up next, Carlo Broussard will be right back with him and with the Protestant challenge right after this on Catholic Answers Live.